State officials say they're moving forward to replenish New Jersey beaches impacted by the weekend snowstorm. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. The Lieutenant Governor and State Environmental Protection Department Commissioner toured several coastal sites today. Also on hand was WHYY's Joe Hernandez, who joins me now live. Joe, welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks, Dave.
What's the extent of the damage?
Well, we're here in Stone Harbor, and if you look around, it doesn't look that bad, actually. This is where the Lieutenant Governor and the DEP Commissioner were. The roads are clear. The snowfall is a lot lower than for somebody in Philadelphia. Here's Lieutenant Governor Guadagno talking about how the state had prepared for the storm today.
When you drive around the state of New Jersey, the day after 30 inches hit the state of New Jersey and you see black highways, you know we were prepared for the storm. And I think that the people of New Jersey need to know that we were on top of it from the beginning and we're still on top of it.
The Lieutenant Governor is speaking primarily to snowfall, but how about flooding? To what extent was that a big problem for the region?
Exactly, Dave. That was the huge problem. And driving around today, you don't exactly see that. A lot of the floodwater has receded. But yesterday, Back Bay flooding was a huge problem for people in South Jersey, more specifically in Cape May County. Towns like North Wildwood, Stone Harbor had some serious flooding. Here's Governor Chris Christie. He was in the state over the weekend dealing with the storm. Here he is talking about the flooding.
DEP reports that the high tide this morning was survived very well by the people in Cape May County. Only minor to moderate flooding, mostly street flooding. We don't see any significant property damage happening in Cape May County.
Joe, I'm not sure that Joe Stella from West Wildwood would agree with the governor's assessment of the minimal extent of the damage. Let's listen.
Horrible. It's the worst I've ever seen it. Once the bulkhead gave out across the street, it was like 8-12 foot waves breaking on us. Right in here. And it was horrible.
Joe, what is the state going to do from this point on to deal with the damage?
Well, they're going to see if the damage to public property meets that $12 million threshold to request funding from the federal government. But DEP Commissioner Bob Martin did say for those sand dunes on the ocean fronts that were washed away in the storm, there would be sand pumped back into those dunes, into those beaches to protect them. What he didn't say was exactly what sorts of aid, what sorts of funding would be sent to those Back Bay towns, those areas where, you know, in West Wildwood, there was just a hole in the bulkhead this morning. Here's what he said about the state's plans to help towns protect themselves from Back Bay flooding.
Right now, the plan is that town by town, we want to have the towns focus on how they're going to handle that flooding over the long haul, because there's going to have to be additional bulkheading put on that side of the towns and all the rest. But right now, there's no overall plan for it.
And back to that $12 million threshold, who will make that determination and what period of time will that be done over?
The Lieutenant Governor and the DEP Commissioner are going to towns today to see the damage. The governor also released a statement today saying the office, the State Office of Emergency Management, will be doing damage assessments. First, the officials say that they need to assess how much damage has been done, what it'll cost, and the governor has said this will take days to complete, so we won't know for a little while.
That's WHYY's Joe Hernandez reporting. Thanks, Joe.
Thanks, Dave.
Meanwhile, major thoroughfares in Philadelphia have been cleared out, though many small residential streets are still unplowed. Joe Moreno with the East Passyunk Crossing Civic Association says he woke to a mountain of snow in the middle of Emily Street, around one block from his house. Plow trucks pushed snow from both sides of the street to the middle, and now the road's completely blocked.
We've traditionally been like the surface of the moon in this area of South Philly. When we get a blizzard like this, I've been living here my whole life, but when we get blizzards like this in the past, it went 3-4 days before they did anything.
Addressing those living on smaller streets, Mayor Jim Kenney pleaded for patience.
Obviously, we need to get our primary streets and secondary streets as clear as possible before we can get to the tertiary streets, to the smaller streets. And I recognize if it's your street, it's important to you. And if you're not out yet, you're frustrated, and I recognize that. But we have to go through this in a methodical way to make sure the city gets back to work as soon as possible.
Outside the city, Governor Tom Wolf thanked PennDOT crews for their work over the weekend. Wolf stopped in Lancaster, Harrisburg, and York to praise the teams driving, repairing, and directing plows to clear streets.
I have never seen a snowstorm like this, and I know you haven't either. And it was faster than we thought. It started earlier than we thought, and it dumped tons of snow on our area, and you responded magnificently.
PennDOT may send crews to assist local governments as early as tomorrow, but a deputy secretary says first the agency wants to ensure it's done enough to clear roads that are the state's responsibility. Nearly half of murders that took place in Philadelphia last year went unsolved. With dozens of killers on the loose, families of victims are reeling, communities are on edge, and authorities are feeling discouraged. Police say the stop snitching culture is to blame, and they're trying to fight it with cash rewards. As WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, results so far have been mixed.
50-year-old Tony Harris was shot to death in October in his row home in Southwest Philly, where he lived with his wife and three kids. After the tragedy, his wife moved out. Harris's brother-in-law, Lloyd Williams, now lives there.
You know, he is my best friend. Every day, you know what I'm saying? Every day, every room in his house, you know what I'm saying? I see Tony.
It's more than just living in the home where his lifelong friend was murdered. Adding extra pain to the grief is that police just don't have enough to catch the killers. Authorities say there were three.
You know, the streets talk, we kind of have an idea of who the people are, but it's not enough evidence for the police to be able to make an arrest, something to make it stick. So, you know, it's been really hard on us just because we're not really getting any closure.
It's a feeling shared by many families across Philadelphia. Police call the percentage of killers they catch and arrest the homicide clearance rate. Police investigators cleared 52% of last year's murders. That's historically bad for the city and well below the national average. Jennifer Selber is the chief of the city's homicide unit.
It's extremely frustrating, especially because when we actually arrest people, our conviction rate is over 90%. So we're incredibly successful in protecting people and keeping communities safer when we can actually make the arrest.
But that's the problem. Selber says they almost always know who the suspect is, but without enough evidence to arrest, police are in a tough spot.
And it's unfortunate because those very people are victimized by having these killers then live in their neighborhood.
The stop snitching culture, authorities say, holds a lot of sway. It keeps key witnesses from coming forward. Sociologist Rachel Waldoff with West Virginia University has studied the phenomenon.
People won't even cooperate with the police anymore because they're in danger, they don't trust them, and they don't see what the payoff is going to be. So what if someone goes to jail? Well, how does that benefit them personally?
Philadelphia officials have tried to answer that question. In recent years, they've offered $20,000 for anyone who can help arrest and convict a killer. According to records obtained from the city, Philadelphia has paid $633,000 on these types of awards since 2013. So it should come as no surprise that District Attorney Seth Williams supports financial incentives.
Well, there's some people that $20,000 is motivation to come forward and share information. There's some people that $20,000 is not enough because they're so worried about retaliation or being shot, murdered, having their car keyed.
But why haven't the cash awards been more successful in putting culprits behind bars? Waldoff isn't surprised. Perceptions, she says bluntly, are powerful.
$20,000, is that going to pay for, you know, the funeral expenses of your entire family, your kids, your nieces, your nephews, your mom? You know, these are real concerns that people have, that if they're seen as cooperating, that $20,000 isn't going to get them very far.
Back in Southwest Philly, Lloyd Williams thinks the real reason it hasn't helped is that people in communities like his don't even know it exists.
$20,000 to some people is a fortune. You know what I'm saying? It'll change some people's lives. Now, I mean, we can get it back on the front page. We can get back in the forefront of people's minds. You know what I mean? And people know $20,000. I could use that $20,000.
Thomas Hargrove runs the National Murder Accountability Project. He says cities with low rates of clearance always have higher rates of murder.
That should hardly be surprising. If you're not catching your killers, that means you have killers walking the streets. And, you know, what's going to happen in that situation? Well, you're going to have more violence than average.
He says financial incentives like this have been around for a while. But what tends to work better is engaging the community. having neighbors knock on doors, relying on neighborhood associations, not just offering money.
Clearing cases saves lives. And usually that is through efforts that more involve smarter policing and especially involve working to create a new atmosphere between the city and the people.
Selber at the DA's office says this is happening too. They partner with lots of community organizations to investigate murders, and they relocate around 80 witnesses and family members a year who fear retaliation after cooperating. When plainclothes homicide detectives go to scenes, she says they surreptitiously slip cards to people. People will talk to them out of the sides of their mouths.
They've even had people that want to look like they're being arrested so that they're looking like they're being taken down against their will and they're not being cooperative.
Yes, the DA's office is willing to fake an arrest if a witness requests it. Anything it takes, Selber says, because with more killers in communities, the sense of hopelessness and lawlessness deepens. Selber says sometimes witnesses have legitimate reasons to be worried about someone trying to seek revenge. But in the majority of cases, the worries are inflated.
It's a culture of fear more than a reality of witnesses actually being injured or killed. That is such a small percentage. So what we're combating is a pervasive fear.
Even though the benefit of cash rewards is debatable, the city will continue to provide a fund for people who speak up. Experts say the city could have all the safety resources in the world, but moving the needle on the clearance rate relies on trust, and that could take decades to really repair. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
Partly cloudy, 34 degrees at 6:18. You're listening to NewsWorks tonight on WHYY. Tonight's low, 29 degrees. Tomorrow, partly sunny, high 43. There is a 30% chance of late day and evening rain showers. Wednesday, partly sunny, high 40. And Thursday, plenty of sunshine, up to 37 degrees. Still ahead, Tom Stoppard's new play takes on the age-old philosophical question, what is consciousness?
I found myself being joyfully battered by it, trying to follow the different arguments Stoppard draws from psychology, brain science, and everyday observation, and then presents like a maestro.
Howard Shapiro reviews the Wilma Theater play, The Hard Problem, when NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY.
You might rightly think of General Electric as the light bulb company, but GE executives say they've got some new ideas shining over their heads.
We've totally changed our direction at GE to be both digital and industrial. And I think, you know, there are a few industries that are not going to have to face into this.
I'm Kai Rizdal, Innovation at Scale, next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Marketplace follows NewsWorks Tonight at 6:30 this evening on WHYY.
Fox Chase Cancer Center, part of Temple Health, supports WHYY and Cervical Cancer Awareness Month. Gynecologic oncologists at Fox Chase Cancer Center perform complex surgeries for patients with cervical cancer. Fox Chase doctors are also actively involved in developing new therapies for treating cervical cancer. Through clinical trials, they are able to offer patients access to promising treatments and experimental therapies that may not be available elsewhere. Now offering next-day business appointments. Learn more at foxchase.org.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Winter is certainly not growing season, but joining me to point us in the direction of some out-of-this-world produce is Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, I have a hankering for salad fixins.
How about a salad of lettuce and zinnia leaves?
Tasty.
It could be especially tasty because the zinnias we're talking about and the lettuce we're talking about are actually vegetable matter grown in space on board International Space Station. Astronaut Scott Kelly has been able to generate a beautiful zinnia plant grown using actual real sunlight.
How so?
One of the later additions to International Space Station was the spot called the cupola, where there are seven windows that look down on Earth and actually allow quite a bit of sunlight to come in. What Kelly has done is he's managed to put this zinnia in that particular location so it could actually get sunlight. And lo and behold, not only did the zinnia respond to his encouraging touch, but with the addition of the sunlight, possibly, it caused the zinnia to bloom. These are all really important considerations when we look into the future of space exploration. You know, the proper nutritional availability for astronauts is really going to be critical, because if you're doing these long-term trips, how else will it be that astronauts can get the vitamins and nutrients they need outside of taking vitamin pills?
And then ultimately, when you get where you're going, say Mars, the ability to perhaps grow produce there.
I actually had a conversation a few months ago with NASA's Jim Green, and I asked Dr. Green if it was actually possible, given what nutrients are already available, quote-unquote available, in the Martian soil with a few additions, could the Martian soil actually support growth of vegetables like potatoes? And he actually agreed that, yes, this could be done. It's not complete fantasy. So these steps that are being made on board International Space Station right now are pushing in the direction of what might be needed if we were to ever establish any kind of base on a place like Mars.
Lastly, let's head out beyond Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, objects that certainly can't be seen with the naked eye, but we're learning more and more about what might be out beyond Pluto.
NASA's thrown a spacecraft out here with the intention to try to better examine this region of our solar system that we might call the Kuiper Belt, or the trans-Neptunian region of our solar system. We're talking about that part of the solar system out beyond Neptune, where we find the largest dwarf planet of the solar system. We now identify, of course, as Pluto. And we also know that there are lots of other objects out in that direction, but we tend to think of them, for the most part, as being really, really small, rocky bodies, more like asteroids or maybe proto-meteorites. However, one of the things that we've been discovering as we learn more and more about this region is that the possibility is growing for finding objects that are near Pluto's size. And in fact, we have been able to identify a number of objects, about half a dozen, that are near Pluto's size or just slightly smaller. We've even named a number of them. And some scientists would even go as far to say that there are objects larger than Pluto out there. Some theories suggest that there's an object that's 4 times the size of the Earth and between 5 and 10 times as massive as Earth. Now, that would be an incredible discovery. But as of yet, we don't have the instrumentation to actually find that object, and we don't know precisely where to look. We have the feeling that there may be something out there based on the evidence that we see of the motion of these objects. A lot more work needs to be done to tie down exactly what's causing their behavior.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight.
You find Earth boring, just the same old, same thing. Come on, sign up without a space, ways incorporated.
Wilma Theater in Center City, Philadelphia, has had a long relationship with one of the world's greatest living playwrights, Tom Stoppard. Stoppard and Blanca Ziska, co-founder and artistic director of the Wilma, are both natives of what's now the Czech Republic. But it's only a part of their relationship, which centers on the challenging theater that Stoppard writes and Ziska likes to present. The Wilma has opened the North American premiere of Stoppard's latest play, The Hard Problem. And WHYY theater blogger Howard Shapiro offers this review.
Tom Stoppard imagined a romantic life for the bard in his film Shakespeare in Love, and his plays have examined such varied themes as mathematic probability, the nature of honesty, and rock and roll as an expression of artistic dissent. Now, Stoppard turns to the subject of consciousness. The Hard Problem, in its production at the Wilma Theater, is nothing less than you would expect from Stoppard at his best. It's an intellectual barrage of ideas and arguments surrounding them, tied together by a plot that seems incidental but ends up masterfully illustrating the concepts. The Hard Problem is named for a phrase coined by Australian psychologist David Chalmers. The problem asks, what is consciousness? What physical forces in our brain, if any, bring it about? Could some scientific equation explain the way we turn experiences into judgments, or how we perceive opportunities and react to situations? In Stoppard's play, a young and eager psychologist joins an institute looking into those very questions. Here, From last year's world premiere of the play by the National Theatre in London, she has an initial meeting at the Institute with others.
So, how would consciousness come about?
I have no idea, nor does anyone else. I thought that's why we're here, to crack the hard problem.
Some people will find the hard problem a hard problem, a heavy-duty mind trip of nearly 2 hours without intermission. But I bet for many people, the play will be a tonic. I found myself being joyfully battered by it, trying to follow the different arguments Stoppard draws from psychology, brain science, and everyday observation, and then presents like a maestro. Under Blanka Ziska's direction, The Womb's production is a combination of excellent decisions, starting with a cast offering outstanding performances and moving on to the way the story's told on an all-white set that makes the play feel like a laboratory experiment. Saxophonist Michael Pedersen strolls the stage between scenes, playing soulful original music by Daniel Perlstein that seems to tell us we're chasing something just out of reach. The hard problem is well within the Wilma's reach. The folks there like to call themselves the nation's foremost interpreter of Stoppard's work. The hard problem makes you see why. It runs at Wilma Theater through February 6. For WHYY, I'm Howard Shapiro.
Finally this evening, while many were stuck inside their houses over the weekend, a group of college athletes found themselves trapped on the Pennsylvania Turnpike, far from the comforts of home. Along with hundreds of other vehicles, buses carrying members of the Temple University women's gymnastics team were stopped on the highway in Somerset Valley Friday night, and it wasn't until nearly 9 o'clock Saturday evening that the famished and tired team members and coaches found refuge and food at a nearby hotel. Around noon yesterday, they climbed back onto the bus and traveled an additional 7 hours, navigating snow-covered back roads as portions of the turnpike were still closed. The women finally arrived on Temple's North Philadelphia campus last night. Safe to say, the team had enough bonding time to last them the rest of the season. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas. Man may one day travel on land at speeds of up to 700 miles an hour. How? Well, some Drexel University students may hold part of the answer. Join us for that story on tomorrow's show. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.
Annenberg Center Live supports WHYY and presents Ballet Hispanico, a contemporary dance ensemble mixing an eclectic modern style with the energy and flair of Latino cultures. Theatricality and passion propel every move when Ballet Hispanico takes the stage on February 5th and 6th at Annenberg Center Live. For tickets to Ballet Hispanico on February 5th and 6th at 215-898-3900 or annenbergcenter.org.